Hi, and welcome back to the Art Podcast with me, Lisa Ferral. First and foremost, once again, it is too hot to function. I am so pissed about this, and I think there's gonna be 5 days of like 32 degrees Celsius outside. Girl, 5 days in a row, and it doesn't get like cool at night here. It gets to like maybe 18 degrees, which is like, what the fuck is this? Honestly, I'm sorry to all of you summer lovers, but summer is the worst fucking season ever. I cannot function. I get cranky, and I wanted to film a Winx video, right? The season 8 review, and I don't know if I'm gonna be able to do that because I need to finish the script. And I can't just start filming today. And today is the last day when it's going to be even remotely tolerable in terms of weather. So I don't know how I'm going to film it. Honestly, I don't, because I can't film. Physically cannot do much of anything, really. I can't eat, can't sleep when it's hot outside. I can't walk around because it's too hot. It's disgusting, okay? And I know that I complain about weather a lot, but I'm always going to be on my icy bitch agenda every day, every single day, without fail. Just saying. Today's topic is going to be about, you know, separating the art and the artist, but a little bit from a different perspective than just talking about the moral undertones of it all, because I think that there is definitely a problem that we're kind of dealing with in terms of existing as artists or scientists or anyone really, who are kind of forced to operate within a system that has been shaped, at least in terms of history, in terms of like what has been written down by people who have not been that great. I have a whole, you know, podcast episode about Picasso, and there's so many artists that I just can't stand as people, that it can genuinely be difficult to find something to either be inspired by or to not be grossed out to reference. Do you know what I mean? Like, sometimes you want to make an artwork and then you realize that these ideas have been explored before. And in itself, it's not a problem that someone else explored it before, because that's just how life is, you know? There's nothing new under the sun. But I think that there's definitely a problem with just how uncomfortable it can be to have to share, you know, a space, imaginary space or academic space with people that you do not like. And I think that today I want to talk about how all of those people who have shaped the art scene or have, you know, been credited for shaping the art scene, how there are a lot of ways of looking at them and their work, with a lot of them addressing the problem or the fact of authorship and being a creator of a certain, you know, piece of media or artwork or whatever. The reason why I even wanted to talk about this is because, I mean, it's been on my mind for a while, because I think that if you have an art podcast, at some point you're gonna have to have an episode about that. And I think that I have touched on it a lot in other episodes. However, I think that it's kind of one of those topics that can be very boring to discuss, because it boils down to your personal ability to separate, you know, the artworks from artists and whatever, and where your morals are, and how much you think a certain artwork was influenced by the person themselves, and how much of it was a kind of just an amalgamation of a bunch of other influences and other people working on it, right? But the reason why I wanted to talk about it this week is because I just watched Red Shoes. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Red Shoes, but it is a 1948 movie that was produced by the Brits, you know. So let me give you a bit of a synopsis, right? I'm just gonna read you the info for it. And of course, I know that most of you will be kind of familiar with it. Actually, I don't know. It's a really old movie, so who the fuck knows? But anyway, in this classic drama, Vicky Page is an aspiring ballerina torn between her dedication to dance and her desire to love, while her imperious instructor, Boris Lermontov, urges her to forget anything but ballet, Vicky begins to fall for the charming young composer Julian Craster. Eventually, Vicky, under great emotional stress, must choose to pursue either her art or her romance, a decision that carries serious consequences. So, I don't know if you guys are gonna wanna watch it or not. I'm usually not against spoilers when I watch things of people discussing things, you know? So I'm gonna talk freely about it. I don't think it's gonna spoil anything, even if you haven't seen the movie. Like, honestly, I think the only reason you would wanna see it is art direction. I guess maybe actually set design. I would say set design is probably the thing that I would say it's worth watching for. But I'm a sucker for the visuals when I'm watching films. I'm not there for a story. I'm there for the visuals. Obviously, the visuals are a part of the story. But even if, I don't know, man, I'm here for the visual part of the experience. Anyway, this movie, I wanted to watch it because I watched a Greta Gerwig interview where she spoke about her influences when it comes to Barbie and like how she put together the set design and everything. People that edited that interview, they put a bunch of clips of the movies that she was referencing as she was referencing them, and one of the clips was from The Red Shoes, and I just really loved that, you know, that clip. It was very short, but it really spoke to me because I think that there's a few projects that I'm working on that this kind of fits within, in terms of being kind of like an inspiration to have visually in front of you, to be able to envision your own ideas better. So as soon as I saw it, I was like, I gotta watch it. Like, I gotta do it, you know? And the movie is, you know, there's like the beginning, and then there's a huge chunk that is basically the performance of the ballet that they put together, which is The Red Shoes, and then there's, you know, the ending part. But the bulk of it, I would say, at least to me, it felt like the bulk of it was the performance, and it is a ballet performance, and the dance is good. But you know what, it was really, really confusing, because at the beginning, when there was a bunch of other dancers involved, I was so confused because the dancing wasn't good. Like, I don't know what the fuck was going on. And but by not good, I don't mean that, like, you know, like they weren't good in the contemporary sense of what we know as dance in pop culture. I'm familiar with ballet. Like, I'm not a goddamn idiot. But I was just like watching, I was like, oh my god, why are like half of them not on beat? What's with the angles? Why is everyone at a different, like, why is everyone's limbs at a different angles that don't make any fucking sense? And I was just kind of confused as to, how is this, are they just gonna be horrible for 2 hours of this entire fucking movie? This is crazy. And then after the first couple of moments where you see like the dancing of those performers, when it turns to the main ballerina and like all of the, like the, I think there's two guys who are also in that ballet, all of a sudden it was like, it was fine, like it was good. So I kind of had like a bit of a strange experience when I was confused as hell for like half of the movie, or like a third, the first third. I was like, come on now, it can be serious. You're telling me this girl is a prima ballerina? Okay. But then when the actress who plays Vicky started to dance in the actual Red Shoes in the ballet that they were putting on, all of a sudden I was like, okay, thank God. Because I was like, this can be real. This can be, like, this is ridiculous. Anyway, first and foremost, I really love how smooth the camera work is in terms of just old movies in general. I love that it's not being jerked around a lot as it is today. And it's just my personal preference. I also really love wide shots. I don't like the hyper zoomed in kind of shit that we have going on nowadays, and this is again just my personal preference. So I was enjoying the visuals of this movie quite a bit, and specifically I thought that the performance and the set design was absolutely fantastic. Multiple moments that I was very impressed by, especially because that this is a very old movie, and I'm not sure how much editing has been done when they recolored everything, because it was obviously a black and white movie at first, but it was filmed in, I believe, Technicolor, so they could recolor everything. The actual ballet is based on a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale about a girl who puts on a pair of red slippers that will not allow her to stop dancing. She must dance and dance in a grotesque mockery of happiness until she is dead. There's a lot of gorgeous shots, moments where the set design is absolutely fantastic, and sometimes it's not even set design, it's just on location and it looks beautiful, but most of it is filmed on sets. You can tell, but even though you can tell, it's still quite beautiful. That's exactly what Greta was referring to when she said artificial realism. And I think that it looks gorgeous. There are multiple moments, like, for example, the one where Vicky is standing at some kind of balcony with Krasner, with the guy that she's going to fall in love with. And they are just watching a train pass by and all the smoke kind of comes up to them. And it is obviously also like foreshadowing that she's gonna, you know, spoilers, get hit by a train. Very Anna Karenina of her. In any case, obviously the performance, the way that it's filmed and the way that it's edited, it's not realistic in terms of how a real ballet would go. There's a lot of obvious, you know, cuts in between scenes that wouldn't be real, like wouldn't be visible in real life. But, you know, I would argue that a lot of really, really good ballet productions come close to how gorgeous this movie is. Honestly, I remember when I was like 11, I went to Bolshoi Theater. I did not want to go. I was like kind of in my, you know, hating all girly things phase. Or maybe I was mad at my grandma. I don't remember which one it was, but I didn't want to go. And my grandma kind of made me. And I remember that I was just like so pissy, just like sitting there like, And then it started and it was Nutcracker. And it was gorgeous. The set design, everything, the way that it was basically magic. I'm not gonna lie to you. The lighting, the way that they were making everything look, the way that it looked like it was actually snowing on stage. It was gorgeous to the point where I was just like baffled how on the fuck of the earth they made it happen in real life instead of like, you know, on screen with a bunch of special effects that you can do in post, right? So that was very impressive. And I would say that even though this movie in many ways looks so unrealistic in terms of how grand and beautiful everything is, I have seen ballets that looked like this, you know? So I can't even say that this is that unrealistic, except for the cuts in between, you know? Because yeah, you can move set pieces around, whatever, but not this quickly. In any case, there is also this moment where one of the guys, they're dancing on stage, and the way that they lit everything up, it looks like it's kind of, I guess, dusk maybe, or dawn, somewhere, something like that is going on in terms of lighting. And the cityscape behind them is very dark. I will put it on the screen for those of you who are watching instead of, you know, listening. And the guy who's also in the ballet, he replaces a piece of what I assume is like a piece of newspaper that's been blown around the stage. And obviously it's done with editing. It's a hard cut between the piece of paper flying around and dancing around with the ballerina and it changing to the guy. And he kind of like replaces it and they dance around together. Do you ever feel like a plastic bag blowing in the wind? You know? And it is gorgeous. Like, when I tell you it is gorgeous, I fucking mean it. So many more scenes. There's one where you can definitely tell that the sky is painted. And I just love that aspect of it. Just the fact that it just has this real quality to it with a lot of depth. So the stage is definitely has a lot of depth to it, and they definitely add a lot more to the depth by painting things and placing lampposts in a strategic way. There's also a moment where I don't know if it's fabric or if they just painted some kind of paper, whatever it is, there's a moment where she's dancing on what seems to be a rock in the middle of both the sky rocks and what seems to be waves on the other side. It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. But also, in the same movie, you come across straight up blackface. Like, girl, I am not a connoisseur of, like, Anglophone old movies. So to me, or not even Anglophone, honestly, like, any Western old movies. So whenever I watch them and I see it, I'm always just, like, a little bit baffled because it's just kind of, just so egregious. It's really something. And it's also very strange that this is just kind of, like, things that are part of the lore of art. And just, like, a thing that we kind of supposed to gloss over. Well, at the same time, this is kind of a thing that you run into absolutely fucking everywhere, and especially in old media, where there's a lot of different types of prejudice, not just racism, but just a lot, like a wide variety of bullshit. And even the fact that this character ends the way that she does, she accidentally gets hit by a train or whatever, it's all, again, part of the issue too. Like, the reason why she cannot decide whether she is going to be married or be a ballerina, right? It's because two men decided that she can't have both. One of them is like, you're gonna have to be a wife, I'm gonna be a composer, but you gotta be a wife. And same with the other guy, who's like, you can't have a husband and have a career, you just have to be a dancer for me and that's it, I'll make you a star. You can't have love or family or anything. This is a very old problem, a very simple problem that just stems from pure misogyny. Once again, I'm just saying that in so much media, you just run into these issues. And when we talk about what we can do about it, or what we should do about it, how we can interact with this media, or can we even interact with this media, there's a lot of bullshit that goes into it, obviously. I think that we should bring in some theory that describes the relationship of, you know, the author and the audience. And on one hand, there's no way an author can write something or make something without their perspective dictating the framing of everything, right? It's kind of like photography. Like, the entirety of the world is available to you, but there's still limitations to how much can fit into the frame, right? And whoever is holding the camera is the one who can decide how much is in the frame and how much isn't. There's one essay that will get brought up a lot if you go anywhere, honestly. Anywhere in the arts, it gets brought up a lot. And that is an essay by Roland Barthes that's named The Death of the Author. The Death of the Author is an influential 1968 essay. It is by French theorist Roland Barthes. The main concept that he tried to deliver through this essay was that as soon as the author is done with the work and it becomes something that can be interacted with by somebody else, there is all of a sudden a lot of ambiguity in a sense of who is speaking, who is delivering these lines, this text. Is it the author? Is it the person? Is it the character? Is it the person who's reading it because they can interpret things in different types of ways? So you kind of get to the point where you cannot quite know whether an author was just trying to reflect the reality, or they were trying to reflect their reality in particular, right? And the thing is, obviously, there are many authors who, you know, prided themselves on believing that you should be stepping away from any particular morality of yourself or any other character in the book. Like, for example, Dostoevsky. His idea was that you have to be writing all characters only as a network of experiences and a network of desires, instead of focusing on one perspective. Basically, his whole shtick was that you cannot focus on one perspective. You cannot try to deliver a story of a one person, kind of. Like, obviously, there's a protagonist, but he is not the one who's supposed to be shaping the narrative, so you cannot... You kind of have to step away from the work yourself and step away from the character. So the character doesn't dictate what's going on around them as much as it is kind of a reflection of whatever you're trying to portray. It's hard to explain. But it also relates to the idea of the carnivalesque, which is an idea that was created by literary critic whose name is Mikhail Bakhtin. What he means by the carnival is the totality of popular festivities, rituals, and other carnival forms. For Bakhtin, like the way that he's kind of trying to explain this idea is by saying that carnival is deeply rooted in the human psyche on both the collective and individual level. That there is this unified carnival sense of the world. The carnivalesque, we're gonna get back to it in some other episode because I personally reference this a lot in my work as an artist, or at least it informs a lot of my theory. We will get back to it later because it's a whole other can of worms and I don't want to open it today. And in basic terms, Barthes kind of talks about the fact that our obsession with authorship is relatively new, is obviously related to a lot of romantic ideas, a lot of ideas of Renaissance, where the individual and the idea of individual has been formed on quite a large scale. Before, it obviously still been discussed. It's not like it was completely foreign idea to people, but it definitely was popularized and a lot of works were created in that kind of mindset or followed this kind of framework in the Romantic period. Roland also oftentimes spoke about the fact that we oftentimes try to understand the intention of the author and try to find who the author is through their work, which by extension also means to me that we do look for those weak spots or perspective issues that can warp the characters or the storytelling in general. And I think that it's quite obvious that it is the case for a lot of authors. I don't even know if it's possible not to have the personal affect the work, but I think that it's interesting to talk about the fact that we're so invested in trying to figure that out. And the most important part of this essay, to me at least, is that Barthes argues that whenever we read something or whenever we, because this was mostly about literary works, but whenever we engage with a piece of art, whether it is literary, visual, whatever it is, we engage with the piece of writing, for example, right now in this moment in 2023, for example, if I were to read a book right now that was, for example, written in 15th century, it's not like I am reading it back then. To me, a lot of the signifiers, a lot of the concepts are quite foreign, and I have to look up a lot of things to make sense of some contextual information. And even then, you never know, you don't have the same perspective or even ability to have the same perspective as people that were reading it back then. A lot of the time, context is missing, and we also don't often know who had most access to this text, right, at the time. Who was the target audience, let's say, right? So even if we interact with an artwork and we interact with the author, trying to examine that author, we will be examining this author outside of their context because we're talking to them or observing them right now instead of when they were actually alive and producing the work. Imposing the author on any type of work would be limiting that work in its relation to you, the viewer or the audience, right? If I am watching this movie, it will affect me in terms of what I see. And I will be seeing a lot of issues, especially those issues that pertain to me, right? So what I'm trying to say is that it is a bit impossible to find works that were, like, you know, forming a lot of the art movements or whatever that don't have those issues that will irk us or make it hard for us to watch it or even impossible for some. But we should try and extrapolate as much as possible, if it doesn't obviously line the pockets of those artists, to enrich our own practices. You know what I mean? Like, use them for what they're worth. Like, I don't think that examining cubism to figure out a particular part of your theory or whatever for your own painterly practice is kind of like bad or something just because Picasso was a dickhead, you know? Like, he was a dickhead, but take what's been done, because the thing is, most of them stole shit anyway. Take what you want from that to examine and extrapolate for your own good if you want to. That's what I'm trying to say. And the idea of the, you know, the death of the author is in many ways also a way for artists to let go of the fear of being misunderstood or misinterpreted. I think I definitely had that problem in my first or second year of university. I remember that I was kind of really unimpressed by how my work has been read in class during the critique. And as far as, like, you know, obviously some critiques are valid, but oftentimes a lot of people's interpretations are going to be informed by a lot of different things that sometimes have nothing to do with you. And as much as I would love for people to get what I wanted them to get out of my work, at the same time, I don't think that it is in any way rewarding. Yeah, I don't think it's rewarding, because you can't really control the way that people perceive what you have created. And right now we're talking about more abstract things, not when you have put something fucked up on a piece of paper and then you're like, well, they're just interpreting it wrong. I think there's obviously a balance to everything. You cannot just be saying that, oh, well, I made this and what I've put into it is the real meaning. Well, at the same time, when someone completely misunderstands your work, it shouldn't... I don't know, girl, I got tired. I just wanted to talk about the death of the author, okay? I wanted to talk about the fact that authorship can limit us from taking what would be beneficial for us, whether as artists or as people, from works that have been preserved from the past, which usually terrible people got to preserve their artworks, as it is true right now as well, but whatever. It's also interesting to just think about this text, about this theory, about the fact that authorship is not as important as soon as it leaves the hands of the author, obviously. Mostly because those works, you will never know the exact intention. And sometimes people lack self-awareness to the point where they don't even know what the intention actually was. I think that, honestly, that might be the case for Tolstoy. Because I'm reading Anna Karenina right now, and with his work, I noticed that a lot of the time he has described something in such vivid colors. He describes people so well, and it's so strange because you can tell that he's trying to position one character as virtuous, as a good person, and the other one as a bad one. Maybe not like trying to, not heavy-handedly, but still you can tell that one of them is supposed to be seen as like a good person and one isn't. And it's so strange because he's also showing like so many prejudices, especially of the time, right? It is crazy because, you know, he's in his personal life, he hasn't treated women well. You know that his wife has, you know, rewritten a bunch of parts of his books, or she like re-edited them, or she even wrote things and he took them from her. But when you look at his work over, so you know that he was prejudiced against women, at least for sure. I don't know about everything, but that for sure. And he was kind of like, you know, a supporter of, you know, the monarchy or whatever. You look at his work and he's trying to portray the workers who are against, you know, the capital being stolen from them as like bums, as people who are like addicts and like terrible people in quotations or whatever, right? But you can't help but actually agree with them and think that they are right. And it's crazy because, like, he didn't intend to create a work that so perfectly encapsulates the society of the time in terms of actually showing everything more or less accurately, but he just ends up doing it accidentally, it seems like, because based on how he's describing some things or whatever, you can tell that he's trying to frame somebody as more virtuous than someone else. He's just kind of failing at doing that because he's so good at describing that you actually get to see a lot of characters for who they are, and you can choose for yourself whether you actually see them as bad or good. Anyway, if you want to watch Red Shoes, you can watch it for the sake of the set design. Yeah. That's the problem with the classics or with, you know, old media. Like, there's a lot of cool shit because resources went into it, but also a lot of it is uncomfortable, and not only uncomfortable, but you have to extrapolate so hard to get shit that you actually need for your own stuff or for whatever. Same with, like, even reading the classics, like, you're just sitting there, like, I think I tweeted about it, that a lot of those characters, it's just being angry about the plight of women and how so many people in their lives, so many men in their lives who were supposed to be on their side, their fathers, their brothers, their sons, their husbands, whomever, how all of them never even seen them as a person, like as a full human being. And I genuinely wish we could just christen all of them Judas, because that's who they are. It's crazy. It's like not a single man in that goddamn book I'm reading right now is actually seeing their family members, half of the population, as people. So whatever, I don't even want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it, because the thing is, we've been talking about it for so long, it's a bit boring, because I wish we were past all the things that we've already discussed, but we're still, like, so often you see people speaking on these topics on TikTok or something, and they're so behind, they're still on second wave feminism or something, and you're like, oh my god, do we really need to talk about this again? I thought we were already deep in the thick of it in terms of intersectionality. I thought that we were supposed to be done with it soon. By done, I mean that everyone kind of got exposed to it and everyone figured it out. But no. It's like we're constantly just in the recycling stage of ideas and constantly having to re-examine everything that was already examined. It's annoying and it's boring. And I wish we didn't have to do that, because it would make so many people's lives easier. Anyway, whatever. Hope you're having a good day. I will talk to you soon. Bye.